From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to America's most listened to late night talk show. Thanks to you, Coast to Coast AM. Ghostly open lines a little bit later tonight. Hey, by the way, welcome more stations to the ever-growing list of Coast to Coast AM families. WLCL 105.7 FM in Atlanta, simulcasting with WGST in at AM. So those of you who want to go between an FM station and an AM station in Atlanta, you may now do it on WLCL. That's 105.7 FM. Also, WHBY AM in Appleton, Wisconsin. Good to have you aboard. WNRX FM in Jefferson City, Indiana. All of them joining the Coast to Coast affiliates list. By the way, don't forget, Sunday, 2 a.m., I always do this Saturday night, actually, before I go to bed. And sometimes I'm so obsessive about it, I even do it at noon on Saturday. Don't forget, turn your clocks back 1 hour. Spring ahead, fall back, for those of you going off daylight savings time. Some of the stories of the day, here we go. Now, you know how we've always been talking about Osama bin Laden was going to pop up sometime in October? Well, a lot of us thought maybe he'd pop up because he'd be captured by U.S. troops. Well, he has popped up, this time on videotape. Osama bin Laden made his first televised appearance in more than a year, in which he admitted for the very first time ordering the September 11 attacks, and he accused President Bush of misleading the American people. Make no mistake about it. The fact that he is on and this tape came out at this time is politically motivated. Injecting himself into the campaign 4 days ahead of the presidential election, bin Laden said the United States can avoid another 9/11-style attack if it stops threatening the security of Muslims. In the portion of the tape that was broadcast, the al-Qaeda leader refrained from directly warning of new attacks, although he said there are still reasons to repeat what happened. Admitting for the first time that he ordered the 9/11 attacks, bin Laden said that he did so because of injustices against the Lebanese and Palestinians by Israel and the United States. Multiple officials, by the way, and terrorist experts suspect that the man threatening vicious attacks against the United States in a purported terror tape is indeed Adam Gadan, a young American who converted to Islam. Their suspicions were echoed by the director of a California mosque. He believes that Gadan is the man in the mysterious video. The Orange County imam who converted Gadan to Islam but was assaulted later by Gadan, said that outside his mosque, it sounds like it is indeed Adam on the tape. The FBI believes the 25-year-old Southern Californian has possible ties to bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. In the video, a man wearing dark glasses and an Arab headdress wrapped around his face claims to be an American member of al-Qaeda and promises attacks that will make the streets of America run red with blood. Seriously ill and perhaps fighting for his life, Yasser Arafat rushed to a hospital, a military hospital near Paris, that specializes in blood disorders. Doctors are looking at him right now. He's very, very ill. He's 75 years old. As you know, we continue our stories about mad cow disease. Now it's been revealed that federal officials have investigated 20 cases for possible human mad cow disease in the last 10 years in New York, where state officials currently are looking into a cluster of 5 cases of a related disease. Now, the 5 cases of what initially appear to be the fatal, incurable brain illness known as CJD, now that's the human form of mad cow disease, recently has been reported in Ulster County and surrounding areas in southern New York. In an amazing story out of the state of Washington, a service dog, his name is Faith, phoned 911 when her owner fell out of her wheelchair. The dog barked urgently into the receiver until a dispatcher sent for help. This 4-year-old Rottweiler has been trained to push the button, and the dog even opened the door to help. Unbelievable. Whitley Strieber's wife, by the way, Ann, is doing better. She is more alert than she has been since her cerebral accident. She is still in, as Whitley writes, vasospasm, spasm, but it appears stable at this time. She has a slight infection and persistent fever. Keep your prayers going for Ann Streber, if you would. Well, in town is a living legend who is in our studios right now. And as you well know, Hilly Rose fills in for Art and me, and he's here because he's going to do part of the show with me tonight. As a matter of fact, Tilly, I'm going to have you do the whole show with me tonight.
No way. Listen, trick or treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat.
You got that right. Hey, what brings you to Los Angeles?
Oh, the NUFOC convention. I don't know if I can say that. And the National UFO Convention, which has got just a lot of wonderful people there. And I wouldn't miss it because everybody's going to be there. The people from Fate Magazine are going to be there, and Peter Davenport's going to be there, and you're going to be there, and I'm there, and all kinds of folks.
As a matter of fact, two of those guests will be our guests in the next half hour and in the half hour leading up to the next hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. An internationally acclaimed physician and health educator, Lynn Kitai, MD, is leading the cutting-edge era of early disease detection and prevention as chief clinical consultant at the world-renowned Arizona Heart Institute's Imaging Prevention Wellness Center in Phoenix. Now, she's also a key witness to the still unexplained UFO mass sighting that took place throughout Arizona on March 13, 1997, called the Phoenix Lights. After 7 years of investigative work, Dr. Lynn is coming forward for the first time over the last several months with startling photographic evidence and personal anecdotes relating to the Phoenix Lights event and much more. Her scientific approach, combined with her own intriguing experiences along the way, makes for compelling, insightful reading. Dr. Lynn has indeed discovered that we are not alone. Lynn, welcome to Los Angeles. How are you?
I'm doing great. Very exciting being here for the National UFO Congress Convention with Lisa Davis and Dr. John Miller.
There's sort of like a Babe Ruth guy in the studio with me here, Hilly Rose. Of course, I call Art Bell Babe Ruth. I'll call you Lou Gehrig. Is that fair?
That's fair.
All right. Very good.
Sure. Whatever. Iron Man. I was just going to say to you, you keep calling me a living legend. Legends are dead. So, Gehrig is dead. So there we are. Hey, Lynn, welcome to you. And I wanted to ask you this question. It says here in your bio, which I never pay any attention to, that you're a key witness to these Phoenix Lights. But come on, weren't there 100,000 people or more who saw this?
Not 100,000, but there definitely were, by estimates, about 10,000 or more throughout the state of Arizona. It just happened to be the evening of March 13th, 1997 was a very clear, calm, beautiful spring night. Many people, thousands of people were outside on that particular night, not only doing their thing, whether it was jogging or going to swim meets or whatever, but looking up at the sky purposely for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp comet, when they also caught a glimpse of this mile to 2 mile wide, some witnesses say, triangle craft. Some people did see a craft. So other people saw lights that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't really see what it was attached to.
Okay, couple of questions.
Right
here.
Over their heads, 30 miles an hour, totally silent, and it was so low in altitude that some people said they could even throw a rock at it. And it traversed from upstate Arizona all the way down to Tucson and then back to Phoenix.
Okay, well, wasn't it also seen in Nevada and other places?
Yes, actually, there are reports that it was seen in Nevada prior to Arizona.
Okay, let me ask you just one more question here.
Sure.
Because I'm very confused about this. You've got this huge object, whatever it is. It's dark in the sky. Now, how do we know that it isn't like two planes on one end and two planes on another end and two planes at the other part of the triangle? In other words, it was silent. Nobody could hear anything. And everybody says it's this vast object. But how do we know?
It was so low to the, as far as altitude goes, and I have to tell you that, you know, myself, and I've been on the show before, and it's exciting to be on your show always. And what I shared with listeners is that my husband is also a physician, and I had a very close sighting of these amber orbs, which some people actually saw detach from the main object, go into the environment, and then reattach with the main object during the mass sighting. That was in 95, and we saw that up close and personal, and I did get pictures of it. And then the lights came back at a distance 2 months before the mass sighting, the second night of which I caught 6 pictures of it in a row of this object head-on turning into a V-shape, confirmed the next morning by air traffic controllers, because I called around, it was so unnerving. My air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor International Airport, they had no idea what it was. They looked at it. Not only didn't it show up on radar, it did not show up on radar, but they looked at it through binoculars. And in their own description, they saw 6 points of light, totally equidistant from each other, massive span, over a mile wide, that moved in synchrony, and they said that it seemed to be attached. They seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't see what it was attached to. This has been said over and over again.
And those lights were uniform. That's important to say that.
Absolutely uniform, and I call them orbs because the light did not extend outside the edge of these round balls. And when you hear the description over and over again, in fact, besides the book, The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone, I am now working on a documentary so that people can hear what other witnesses say. I mean, it's so detailed and so heartfelt. From all walks of life, children to senior citizens, and when you hear their description of these unexplained phenomena, it is just spellbinding, compelling, and you know that they saw something that to them was out of this world.
Lynn, the object that they saw, could they see through it? In other words, there was a beautiful...
Some people could. Some people actually, and it's interesting, it's a really good question, because there were so many witnesses, and different witnesses saw different things. Now, whether, and it has been postulated that there could have been several different events going on at the same time, sort of a parade throughout Arizona, or was it one thing that kept on changing? We don't know for sure. Was there lights with a field in between? My pictures, actually, if you get on my website, www.thephoenixlights.net, you can see in the pictures, especially the second one, which was in the series of 6 2 months before the mass sighting, every other one is bigger or smaller. And what we speculated is that what I caught actually was this thing, the right arm of which was closer and the left arm was further away, with a field in between the lights. But some people actually saw what they describe as gunmetal. I mean, they saw a craft. Some people saw windows and beings looking at them as intently as they were looking up at the object. There were many different descriptions, but nonetheless, they were very similar, and whatever this thing was, it seemed to be in a triangle formation.
What I'm trying to get at, Lynn, is if you could see up into the sky, were there a lot of stars up that night?
What some witnesses described was kind of like looking through water. Like something was there, some kind of field was there, and
so it wasn't opaque. You could see through it.
You could see through it, although other people said, and I know this gets complicated, but some people, this object went right above their cars. I mean, we're talking doctors and lawyers and whatever, looked up at this thing, and it blocked out the stars. So they knew something was, in fact, I just interviewed, I'm doing a documentary that hopefully will get.
Well, there have been reports, though, that this object looks like it's up there in the star system, because it has little star-like lights underneath it. As Hilly was saying, it gives it the appearance that it just may not be solid, right?
Right, right. To some people.
In fact,
I just interviewed a gal from that had a hospice group. They were hospice volunteers that were meeting, and this thing, this whole group realized that something was above them, blocking out the stars. And then as it passed slowly over them, 30 miles an hour, and some people did see it take off at a tremendous speed, but as it passed right over them, they knew that something spectacular had just happened. They didn't know what, but something quite extraordinary had passed right above them. So there were many different descriptions, but nonetheless, the witnesses' descriptions are very heartfelt and detailed.
Lynn, what I'm trying to understand here, and you know, I'm on your side. I believe that there was something there that's inexplicable, but... I have to be the agnostic here, and I have to ask you, could you know the Blue Angels, for example, do precision
fly? Forget planes. This was one solid object. Let me make that really clear.
That's what I want to know. How do you know it was one solid object?
Pardon me?
How do you know it was one solid object?
You know, there's, you know, thousands of people have talked about it, have described it. And again, some people saw a solid object with windows. Again, so other people saw these lights that seemed to be attached to something. Whatever it was 1 to 2 miles wide. And, you know, all I can tell you is that it was extraordinary. It was definitely not planes. I mean, people that saw this thing laugh at other people coming up with these balloons, planes, flares, whatever, because they know what they saw. And it was huge. It was massive. It was just so anomalous that it really struck them. At some people at a very soul level. I mean, it really transformed people. And you talked about the lights, and that's a very interesting question, because some people were actually situated right as the object passed over them. They actually looked into what they called a light well, and they could see in their description the light well, which some people describe as 6 feet wide, had like light in it. It wasn't really...
Get a drink there, Lynn. Get a drink, huh?
Excuse me.
Poor girl. See what you got her so upset, Hilly? She's choking. You okay, Lynn?
I guess she's not.
She's...
Okay, George...
She'll be back.
I hate to take the opposite point of view here.
Well, no, we're just trying to find out what it is.
But look, how many different people saw different things?
Well, the other thing right now is, since this episode, so many people are seeing an object that looks like this all around the country.
But not this big?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Absolutely this big. As a matter of fact, some police officers in Millstadt, Illinois, saw one this big. But they're very close to military bases, which is very peculiar.
Hmm. You back with us, Lynn?
She's still choking.
Still choking.
I'm sorry. I've been talking all day.
Well, you better get your breath. You sound like Bill Clinton now. Huh?
you want to get some water?
I'll be okay.
Go ahead and get some water. George and I will just chat here.
You don't. Do you need us to call somebody? Are you okay?
No, I'm great.
You're what?
Sorry about that.
I mean, you're okay. You can breathe, right?
Yeah, I'm just fine.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Yeah. I once had a guest who fell asleep,
George. Around the world, too.
What was that, Lynn?
As you said, these have been seen around the world.
Oh, they're all over the place.
Countries.
Now, the other thing, though, the official explanation as of right now is what? That these are Hilly flares. That's what they're saying.
Is that what the military
said? No, that was five months after the fact.
Yeah, but, I mean, isn't that what they've stuck to?
Actually, they said it might be flares.
Well, what are they saying now? They've attacked you, Lynn. They've tried to get you out of the picture.
The mile-long triangle trap has never been explained.
Okay. Hey, we're going to let you go because you're choking to death on us.
No, I really apologize.
Your conference is tomorrow. You've got a speech at 10:30 in the morning at the Renaissance Hotel in Hollywood, California, the National UFO Conference. Hilly will be there. I'll be wandering around there as well. Lynn, I've seen your presentations before. You do a phenomenal job, the videotape and the work that you bring. Go get your composure for tomorrow. Thanks, Lynn.
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. And look at my website, because we have some new pictures on there and a two-minute trailer.
Okay.
Documentary.
All right. Appreciate it. That ever happened to you on the air, Hilly, where something happened to your voice?
No, not really. Not really. I had a lady who fell asleep while we were talking to her, and we finally had to call the police, and they came and broke the door down and found that she was okay.
I had a guest about a year ago, witch, who fell asleep while I was interviewing her. So I'm convinced now that some of my interviewing techniques need to be polished up a little bit. She did. She just, hello, are you there?
George Norris is an ambulist. I don't want to leave this subject because it's so darned interesting.
Well, you got 40 seconds to tell me about it.
Well, that's what I don't know. I mean, she spent 7 years studying this. What's new here? I mean, it's sort of like
it's
Roswell.
Gone. That's the problem. It's gone. Except, and this is very important, this kind of object is getting reported all around the world now. Huge triangular-shaped object. Now, sure, you said this large. Most of these are several football field lengths wide. Mm-hmm. This one was big, real big, and I'm not sure Hilly, if we'll ever get to the bottom of this one.
And always near bases?
Military? The ones that are coming out now are very close to military bases.
Then we have to assume that there's something going on.
Well, assume. You never know. We'll be back in a moment. We've got Richard Dolan, UFOs in the National Security State. He will be our guest right here. I'm George Norrie. Hilly Rose is with me. And then next hour, we'll start our ghostly open lines. And Hilly's got some information about Halloween, which I think you'll find interesting. But we'll be back in a moment. Oh, yes, I got to tell you, too. We're going to have a Halloween hotline next hour. Back with that number, too. Richard Dolan next. We'll be right back.
Can't believe what you're hearing? Listen to it again when you sign up for Streamlink at www.coasttocoastam.com. It's only 15 cents a day. Is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Hilly Rose is with me today, the legend. After Dark newsletter, have you subscribed to it yet? Well, if you have not, you should. As a matter of fact, the November issue is all about the hollow earth theory. And when you subscribe or renew, here's the good part. You'll get a free CD, Art Bell's interview, classic interview on Mel's Hole. All you have to do is call 1-888-727-5505. Operators are there right now. 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Richard Dolan was born in Brooklyn, New York, the son of a police officer, nurse. As an undergraduate student at Alfred University, he studied history, English, philosophy, discovered a very deep passion for the discipline of history. Richard did his graduate work at the University of Rochester, where he focused on German and Soviet studies before moving on to the American Cold War diplomacy. Around 1994, Richard became interested in the topic of UFOs, and for the next few years, he spent most of his time conducting a systematic search, hunting down many out-of-print books and UFO documents released over the years through the Freedom of Information Act. What resulted was a concise historical narrative of the UFO problem. He is our guest right here on Coast to Coast for what's left of this hour. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Hi, George. Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you're going to be at the National UFO Conference as well, right?
That's right.
Okay,
yes.
Very good. And our friend Hilly Rose is with us now, too, Richard.
Hi, Hilly.
Hi, at 9 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. I mean, that's a little early.
Well, I'm on East Coast time right now, so
oh,
I'm really
you're going okay. You're okay. listen, what I don't understand, Richard, and I yeah. will, because I will get up and attend your lecture, what is this business about national... I mean, your name of your book is UFOs in the National Security State.
Right.
What's a national security state?
Ah, good question. Thank you for asking. I have, I guess you could say, a dual thesis in my book. I look at the UFO phenomenon, first of all, as it intersects with what you might call the national security community. Okay, so in other words, looking at it as a historical development, studying documents, finding out were the intelligence and military community interested in this? Were they not interested? The answer is they certainly were. But what is the national security state? It is my argument, my belief, that we've had in the last, let's say, 60 or so years in this nation, a kind of national security revolution in which, by degrees, I think it's fair to say, you've had a part of our government, a part of our society that has increasingly moved away and out of any kind of accountability. And I would call that a national security state. And so I think the significant thing about our society is that not only have we developed a kind of an ultra-black, unaccounted-for part of our society, but this group has had very, very significant intersection with the UFO phenomenon.
Well, are you implying that the United States government, or any government for that matter, really has paid attention to UFOs? I know they do, but they don't tell us about it. And you're saying there's no accountability. There never was accountability.
Right. So what are you asking?
Well, what I'm asking is, I'm trying to understand what your thesis is. We can go all the way back to Roswell,
right,
where, you know, they told us, yeah, well, there was dummies coming down, or flares or whatever they decided to tell us at the time. So there was no accountability at that time.
Correct.
And there still isn't any accountability.
Exactly.
So what's the difference? What's happened over the years that you say is getting worse?
Well, what's happened is that, you know, you have World War II, which basically created an enormous kind of scientific military nexus here that this had never existed in American history before. I mean, before the Second World War, you had scientists basically working, you know, on their own for no money, doing their own thing. And after World War II, a lot of these guys got co-opted by kind of, as Eisenhower called it, a military-industrial complex. And so I think that's quite significant, that's all.
Richard, do you have any doubts at all that what is happening on this planet right now is a massive visitation by extraterrestrials from who knows where, but it's going on a regular basis?
I believe that is the most viable theory, yes. Now, I mean, either that or what you can say is this. I mean, I try to kind of line my ducks up and try to gauge the facts, you know, which is the most important piece of evidence and so on. What is beyond a shadow of a doubt, what's a slam dunk, is that there is technology in the skies and in the oceans, for that matter, and in the atmosphere, in space, that is not supposed to exist. Okay, so there are objects going back to the 40s, going back to the early 50s, we have military documents to prove this, indicating objects being able, for example, to stop on a dime, take off like a bullet, mm-hmm. violate sensitive airspace at U.S. bases with impunity.
And they weren't ours.
Seem to have been ours. Or if they're terrestrial, then the only thing that you could say is that this is an ultra-black, ultra-rogue group. I mean, maybe it's not associated with the U.S. government, but there's someone. Now, I believe that it's... I think that there's good reason to believe that it's actually not us at all, not human. The question, one interesting question to ask in the last, 30, 40 years is, to what extent are some of these things ours, and to what extent are they not ours? I mean, I think that it's likely that over the years, some of this technology has been recovered by human elements, American military and so on, and I think that they've had some time to play around with this and figure out how some of this stuff works. And so now you're in a situation over the last few decades where, if you see a UFO in 1948 take off like a bullet, stop, and then take off and, you know, zip away, you might think, okay, there's no way that we have the technology to do that. Now, if you see that today, well, now it's a little tricky because, you know, as Lynn Katai was, and you were discussing with her, the triangle phenomenon, we've had triangles now that have been absolutely no question that they've been around for at least 25 years and probably longer. But if you see a triangle today that can do that sort of thing, is it ours or not ours? And there's a legitimate argument, as far as I can tell, within the intelligence community over this. There are some people who think, yeah.
Well, Richard, if indeed it is ours,
right,
why wouldn't we be using it in Iraq?
This is the magical question. There are those in the intelligence community who believe that we used triangular aircraft in the first Gulf War, the famous, infamous TR-3A Black Manta, which is rumored to be a reconnaissance platform that supposedly accompanied F-117A, the stealth fighter, on its mission. Now, that's a triangular planform, and there are triangular aircraft that have been seen, absolutely seen and confirmed by very reliable people in conjunction with U.S. military craft. For example, in the North Sea in 1989, There was a man named Chris Gibson who was an expert in aircraft recognition. This guy competed in international contests where they'd flash instantly like a picture of an aircraft, and you'd have to identify it. This guy's working at an oil rig, and he sees a black matte triangular craft in a refueling operation with a KC-135 tanker accompanied by two F-111s. Guy saw it. And everyone in the aerospace community believes this guy. I think he's probably reliable. So if that's true, what did he see? He saw a triangle, a perfect triangle. It's not a B-2. It's not anything like that. So it's something that's not supposed to exist, and that's 1989. Okay, did we use them in the Gulf War? Well, we may have. I mean, look, think about the press coverage in the Gulf War. It was totally non-existent, basically. You know, so there wasn't much of an independent media coverage of the Gulf War, either the first one or the current war in Iraq. So it's quite possible.
Wait, what do you mean there wasn't independent media coverage?
Well, think about Peter Arnett. You know, Peter Arnett was the one guy in CNN who was in Baghdad. He got completely vilified.
Well, he was there at he was in the right place at the wrong time, I guess you could say.
Right. So the point being that there was very, compared with prior campaigns, fairly limited.
Well, this is true, George. As a matter of fact, my son covered the war with for ABC, and he said they wouldn't let him out. In fact, what they did, they finally said, okay, fine, here's a Jeep, go out. But,
yeah.
but they wouldn't let him get anywhere near the fighting. So, yes, he's right about that. But my question remains, you know, here we are these many years later. If we have these tools, why aren't we using them in Iraq? Lord knows we need them.
I think there's a couple of good reasons. I think it would be very difficult, for example, for the president or for someone to, like the president of the United States, to go before the country and discuss the reality of this, because I think the implications are far too difficult for us to wrap our brains around. In other words, the best analogy that I can think is back in 1985 when Gorbachev becomes leader of the Soviet Union. He starts talking about glasnost and perestroika, openness and restructuring, and the whole world is going, holy smokes, wow, Soviet Union. 6 years later, there's no Soviet Union. And basically because the reforms spiraled absolutely out of control. In the U.S., you talk about UFOs. The president says, okay, it's come to my attention. UFOs are real. They're apparently alien. And what does he say then? You know, good night, everyone. I'm going. No, because then you got a million follow-up questions. It's not just technology.
You also get the possibility of panic.
You get that. You get questions like, gee, what about abductions? They suddenly all these people, maybe they're telling... Maybe it's a logical thing, right? You know.
Well, wait a minute. I'm confused here. We were talking about the realities of the military using
Pandora's box a little bit.
Well, yeah, but I'm asking now if indeed it's extraterrestrials or something else that is manning this craft. For what reason?
I don't know. Don't know.
What do you mean?
You know, I can't get inside their heads. I'm very cautious in certain ways. Okay.
I mean, is there a private deal cut between them and us?
Your guess is as good as
people
mine.
People say so. There are those who say so.
I mean, look, is it this?
What if they? What about
like
this, though, Richard? What if they're time travelers, which is also a real possibility?
Absolutely possible. I would not have thought so when I got into this 10 years ago. Is it possible? Yeah, I think it is. Understanding what space time is, I mean, maybe it is possible. The situation is like you're putting together a 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and some guy took out like half the pieces, put a few fake pieces in there, and you got to figure this out. And then there's people yelling over your shoulder, "You're doing it wrong." That's what UFO researchers are in a situation of doing these days. So what I try to remind people is you have to distinguish between what you know and what you do not know. And I do not know what they are. I mean, I can speculate. What I do know is that there is something very, very significant that is not being explained. And furthermore, that there are people within our, let us call it government, they're not being especially responsible, but there are people who know. There are people who know, and they're not telling us.
Well, Stephen Greer,
the democratic system.
Stephen Greer said on the program last night, indeed what you've just said, Richard, and that is there is a higher group that is not reporting to anybody, and they know lots more.
I believe that is the case.
All right.
I believe the evidence points best to that. Let me just say that.
They're not even reporting to the president.
That's right.
Right, I think that's right. I think that the president, some presidents may have been in, and some presidents most likely were not in.
Mm-hmm.
And that your formal position may not have an awful lot to do with how much you know.
Well, where does this all take you, Richard? I mean, you've been pounding away at this for a number of years. Are you making any headway?
Well, you know, I think that I am in terms of my own personal learning and figuring this out and writing about it. I'm working on the second volume. Volume one just covers the first half of this historical narrative, 500 pages dealing with the 1940s or the early 70s. I'm working on the second and final volume, which will take the story to the present day. I've got a lot of research done on it. Here's what I have sought to do. I have a very modest goal and a very radical goal. My modest goal is simply to write this history because I feel it deserves a valid, academically treated type of history, which it has really not received. You know, any topic you want to know about in history, my feeling is you should be able to find a good 500-page book and read about it. And that is what I sought to do in writing this book.
What do you find, though, to be the most profound thing you've ever investigated? I mean, that just floors even you.
Well, great question. Wow. I'll probably come up with another one in 5-10 minutes, but I'm part of the UFO study got me into an analysis of the remote viewing phenomenon done by CIA and various Army elements during the 1970s and 80s. I got into that because a lot of these remote viewers are really big time into UFOs. I mean, absolutely. And I just, you know, I wanted to look into the connection. And I became convinced, due to researching this, that remote viewing phenomenon is real. And simply, what is remote viewing but being able to see across time and space? And my study of that really forced me to kind of rethink my own conception of what space and what time is. And kind of took me out of, I think, what was formerly a Victorian materialist mindset into something totally different. I mean, for example, it was the remote viewer Joe McMonagall who was able to remote view a Soviet Typhoon-class submarine in 1979 before the thing was even done. No one at the National Security Council believed him. They said, this is nonsense, psychics, what is this garbage? McMonagall said, okay, fine, you don't believe me. Put your satellite over these locations in 4 months. You'll see it dockside, and boom, there it was.
Well, something's going on. The great remote viewer, Ingo Swann, who was a dear friend of my late aunt, the psychiatrist who was into the paranormal, Dr. Shafika, wrote in his book about the artifacts in the structures on the moon.
Correct, yeah.
And Ingo wrote about it. I mean, when you talk to Ingo and you realize just how significant this person is in not only the remote field, the remote viewing field, but just as a human being.
He's an extremely brilliant man.
You sit back and you go, oh, my God, what's happening?
And Ingo is certainly the real deal.
Yes, he is.
What I wonder, because I've talked to Joe McGonigal and a lot of other people who were in this program, but the government shut it down. If it was so effective, why did they shut it down?
Did they shut it down?
Well, the leaks were basically blew it out of the water. I mean, this program was coming out. Jim Mars, journalist researcher, was about to write a book on this anyway, and it was going to come out. And I think, you know, in any of these situations, you had intelligence people said, all right, look, it's going to come out. Let it come out in the way we want it to come out. And they completely just misled the public on the nature of the remote viewing program. There was a study done on it. One of the members of the study was a psychop, as an ultra-skeptical member. And basically, they looked at the program in its last year when it was very ineffective and in a state of shambles. And they made their entire basis of the program on that, you know, tiny, tiny sample, when in fact the heroic era of the remote viewing program was in the 70s and 80s.
What if it went deep undercover and it's still
absolutely
around?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously that's what they did. Obviously,
it's still out there somewhere. Yeah.
I have to ask you, you know, this business of a UFO cover-up.
Yeah.
I think you agree. I agree. George agrees. We all agree that there's a cover-up.
Right.
But why is this so important? We've all lived our lives. Nothing much changes. If they're out there, they're out there. Why should we care?
It's an excellent question, and people need to know. I mean, first of all, why would someone care, right? I mean, we've got to work 40, 50, 60-hour weeks. We got things to do. Why would we care about this whole thing? Here's why it matters, okay? First of all, I'm going to go to my grave with this odd belief that truth somehow matters. I mean, I believe this. Call me an idealist. Call me whatever. I believe in this little thing called truth. And I believe, furthermore, that in a society such as our own that prides itself on being an open society, when you have something like this, a secret, it eats away. It's a cancer at your republic. It's a cancer at the fundamentals of what you want to claim your society is about. And this is the significance of the title of my book, in a way, UFOs and the National Security State, because the UFO cover-up, one thing that it has done is it has corroded, it has contributed, all right, let's say, to the corrosion of this old republic of ours, and it's something that's very close and dear to my heart, something I believe in. A society based on secrecy is not a society that I think most Americans want to be part of, and yet it's become part of it. And we become so cynical, we think, well, you know, that's just the way it is, but that's not a good thing. So that's one thing. There's another reason the UFO cover-up is very important, because we may want to know what the heck makes these things do what they do. I mean, we're in a situation where our global energy situation is getting kind of dicey here. I mean, there are legitimate oil industry people, for example, wondering, hey, how much oil is in Saudi Arabia after all?
Who knows?
All right? It's a big question, and it may not be as much as the Saudis have been saying all these years. It very well may not be. I don't know. But if not, we got a serious, serious oil infrastructure problem right in our laps anytime soon. Now, you take that knowledge, and then you look at, say, the famous Belgian Triangle case of 1989-1990. Here's an object that could almost nearly stop on a dime, silent, takeoff, multi-Mach speeds, dropped 4,000 feet in 1 second, according to Belgian Air Force radar, almost a mile in 1 second. What does that? So the question what people might want to ask is, what is the source of energy? What makes this thing go? You know, us little plebes down here on the ground might want to know. And yet what has happened is we have become so indoctrinated with this kind of subservient national security ethos in our society that we don't even bother to ask.
Well, Richard, good luck at your speech at the conference, the National UFO Conference at the Renaissance Hotel, Hollywood, California. I'm going to be out there. Hillary, of course, will be there. And many others, too, will want to hear a little bit more about what you have to say. Thanks, Richard.
Hey, thank you. Look forward to meeting you at the conference, Hillary.
Good.
Okay, we'll look forward to Richard Dolan. In a moment, we'll come right back with Open Lines. And we're going to open up a Halloween hotline for you, so get ready. I'm George Norrie, Hilly Rose with me tonight. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.